Welcome to a very special bonus episode of The McFuture. I'm Steve Factor, and this is part of my conversation with Jeremy Rifkin. We had a very healthy 3+ hour conversation, so there were a lot of highlights. But I chose this particular section because I think this is where we have the most trouble collectively. It's not with technology or economics, but in how these things really impact our lives socially. Jeremy's written a few books on the subject, especially The Empathic Civilization and Zero Marginal Cost Society as well touches on it. You can see the links in the show notes. Just a quick note, the audio on this episode is not the best. In addition to all the normal challenges of recording a phone call, I was trying to record my end with a headset mic, so it sounds like I'm doing sex talk, but I don't think it'll affect your ability to enjoy this episode. Here it is.
In the long run, as the infrastructure comes in for this third industrial revolution, the employment's going to shift to the social set, the social economy and the commons. Absolutely. Because those are the places where you require humans. Machines are not replacements, they're supplemental. You will never have a robot in a child care center interacting with babies to teach them how to be a human being. The robot will bring them the orange juice and peanut butter sandwich at lunch. There are so many aspects of life that require human engagement. We're a social creature. We pass on our knowledge in ways that are culture to each other in these ways. And if you look at the commons, the nonprofit or not commons part of the community, in America it's 10% of the paid employment right now. It's 13-14% of the employment in Europe. And this is where you get paid fees for services. You have volunteers, but you have paid employees. This is where you create social capital. This is a higher calling, if you will, than sitting there becoming a machine and tending a machine in mindless work. I'm not an optimist or a pessimist, and I'm actually an anti-utopian. I think if we get any of this right and we stumble through to this, maybe their great-grandchildren will look back and they'll say to great-grandma, what did she do all day long? And they'll say, well, great-grandma, she sat at a machine and took a plastic bag and put widgets in a plastic bag 8 hours a day. And they'll say, what did great-grandpa do? Well, he drove a truck back and forth along the same road, 10 kilometers every single day for 40 years. Those kids will be as nonplussed about that as we are about serfs and slaves of a former period of history. So we're so locked into believing that the only way people can have a constructive mission in the world is to be efficient, if you will, attendants to machines, that we can't imagine a human being's worth after that. Well, that's silly.
Here's my observation. I don't know if you've noticed the same thing, but let's look at the bell curve of education. The vast majority are, let's say, C students or somewhere between, you know, C minus and B minus. They're certainly not bad people. They work hard. They want to do a job. They want to be employed. They want to have family. But the disproportionate number of good jobs that this world is currently creating is on the high end. So you've got the A and the B plus students competing very hard to get to those great jobs. The rest are forced, even though they could be great skilled workers, they are forced into the service sector or maybe to be out of the job market altogether. So now you've got this one-time spike that you're projecting, which is wiring up this new society. Now, the question, though, is I think back to something Mike Rowe talks about. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's the host of Dirty Jobs. And he has a mission to get people into skilled labor. And the argument that he makes is he's like, there are 3 million unfilled skilled labor jobs each year in this country that nobody wants. Maybe because, you know, they're not glamorous, they're not located in really cool cities with nice coffee shops, but there's a 3 million job surplus in this category and nobody wants. So he's almost forced to go on a PR campaign for skilled labor, which to me sounds like the kind of skilled labor you're describing that will be necessary to wire up the infrastructure. So why don't people want these jobs, and why they're already not taking these jobs? Maybe they're busy making YouTube videos or who knows, doing podcasts. The concern that I have is, why would you expect them to suddenly want these jobs?
Well, I think these jobs are a scale. They go all the way from unskilled, semi-skilled, skilled, professional. It's the entire infrastructure. You're not limited to just the unskilled or semi-skilled. You can pony on up with increasing adult career education. We do that in Europe. Go to the Scandinavian companies, Germany. Part of the unemployment benefits is upgrading your skills for all of these areas. So I think the biggest problem is the school systems themselves. They were designed as factory systems, and they were designed to be like centralized factories that look like factories.
Yeah, to make good little workers.
Yeah, just tailor us little workers. Knowledge is power. Francis Bacon's dictum's on the front of every building. The kids learn if they share information, which is the most social thing we can do. It's called cheating. They have to take orders. They have to get efficient. The bell rings. They got to produce the product. In other words, what they're learning in school is such a disconnect from what they do on the internet, where they're crowdsourcing, they're using their creativity, they're editing each other. They're doing all of these creative things collaboratively on a commons, and then when they go to school, they're bored stiff. So what I'm saying is that the digital revolution requires a digital education. It's not just training vocationally, but bringing in the cultural, the social, the anthropological aspects of preparing young people for a completely different way of living in the world. Let the machines do the heavy lifting, as Lord Cain said. We should be able to transcend that. We use a very small portion of our brain. It's not because people are lazy. It's because of the narrative they've been forced into. We needed, during the industrial age, that school education prepared millions of people for dead-end jobs that had to be done, the lower end, and then a smaller number at the top. But if you have a whole generation growing up on a digital revolution where they're used to producing all sorts of virtual goods and physical goods and things for each other, they're already in a mentality of a global access planet economy that's much more democratized, much more social entrepreneurial than individually entrepreneurial. That's why Brooklyn impressed me when I went there. I had not seen that in California, but I saw it in Brooklyn.
As society moves on, we forget the underlying skills, right? Driving goes away. We're not going to know how to drive. We already don't know how to repair anything. As things get easier and more automated, we forget all the stuff. So we could never rebuild the society. So we're standing on all of these platforms that have been built, sometimes through some very ugly, nebulous, or corrupt means. But we tend to not question them anymore because we're operating at this top tier where everything looks collaborative, looks like fun, but we take for granted that the fact that Google is using our data a certain way. We take for granted that cell phone licenses have been issued or a spectrum has been issued in a very undemocratic way. Is it okay for us to stop questioning the underlying infrastructure and just enjoy the fun at the peak, or should we still stay diligent, and how do people stay diligent about how this platform we're on got built in the first place?
My biggest worry is twofold. One is the dark net. We lose open access. We can't address privacy, data security, control over our creative content, and cybercrime and cyber terrorism. Every day I think about that. The second thing I'm worried about is just what you said. A survey was done, and what they found, National Endowment for the Arts, is that reading and writing comprehension has gone down by one-third among American college graduates in less than, I think, 15 or so years, 20 years. It's devastating. Why do I say that? If you take a look at every other communication revolution in history, they've allowed us to extend our vocabularies and be able to express feelings, unique feelings that are only unique to a specific moment, so that we could actually deepen our empathic ability and our neural circuitry to communicate with each other in more meaningful ways. For example, an oral culture with a very limited vocabulary, you had no storage. So you had to be with aphorisms and rhyme.
We have to do it through emoji, which is back to cave paintings.
And I think that's something we're not paying enough attention to, because what's ironic is we have a communication revolution for the first time in history that can connect the entire world in real time, but we have less ability to express ourselves on that medium, even though all the words are stored there. It's why kids don't know how to do math anymore, or with Waze, we don't have to know maps anymore. So in a sense, this is very dangerous. We have to find a way. We have to ask the question I asked in the book, The Empathic Civilization. We're connecting the world digitally. To what end? What's the purpose? We're connecting the whole world. We're connecting every human being. What is the purpose of this? No one ever asked that question.
In this new world, how do we come to an answer? Because once we have all of these conveniences and once we're all wired up, both in the physical and the virtual world, then what is that purpose? How are people going to be equipped? Because school doesn't prepare us to do that.
Let me explain what we're doing in northern industrial France. This is an old mining region. These are all workers in a rust belt. They're all putting solar panels and they're doing retrofitting and they've got smart businesses. These are all former miners. Well, we've got 7 universities and 200 high schools there. The 7 universities have created a consortium led by Catholic University of Lille. All the teaching now has to be cross-disciplinary, multi-perspective teaching, so that the students there understand there are various perspectives that you bring to a subject so that you can think more systemically, more mindfully, and make the connections. So that's number one. Number two, the students are put in teams. The teams have to teach each other. The professor becomes the facilitator. But the students have to teach each other. They have not yet eliminated, but they're in the process of moving toward the period where no grades. But you will be certified by your team. Your team either certified that they understood and passed the course, or they didn't. And not quite there, but they're moving that way. Then their education has to be clinical, theory and practice. So what they learn has to be learned and applied in the communities where they live, so that it actually benefits the commons. This could never be done by a small group. It's by the whole region mobilizing because they have no course other than that. What's their plan B? This is the oldest industrial region of France that turned into a rust belt, and there's nothing going on there. They have to motivate themselves. If this old industrial mining region can do this, this can be done everywhere. But this requires a different approach to education. It requires people take control over their social, political, and economic life. And once they start feeling they're motivated, they will move. So, for example, in Haute, France, the government just plays a facilitating role, like the teacher. The right. government doesn't create the plans. They facilitate. They bring in the universities, the schools, the business communities, the neighborhood associations, and then they work with us because we have technical expertise, and they create the proposals. And once they actually begin to deploy and create the businesses and they're part of the social capital, the motivation and drive is extraordinary. And we just tell people, please come and just see it for yourself.
You mentioned motivation and drive. In this new world that you're describing, people really need to have a curiosity. They have to have a desire. And we have a lot of people who simply don't, who haven't either been conditioned or maybe don't have the family infrastructure or whatever reasons. You know, if you look at the distribution, there's a lot of C students that really were built for working for someone else, not creating their own thing, which is what this world is going to demand, whether it's for pay or not for pay, really motivating yourself to have a purpose in a life where the world no longer hands you one.
Yeah, I agree with you, and that's because we have a moribund school system. Go to Finland, for example. They're the number one school system in the world. How do they do it? No big deal. Every 40 minutes in a class, they break open and everyone goes outside for 15 or 20 minutes and just has unstructured social play and whatever they want to do. Well, we say that's a waste of time. They're the number one school system in the world. They motivate and drive the young people, are motivated to be self-starters, not in this strict entrepreneurial tradition. You know, if we simply want to provide an education so everyone can be a Steve Jobs and create a company and make $1 billion, that's not what this generation's about. What I'm finding out as an old person looking at it, I've seen three category changes in the younger generation, and I could be wrong because I don't have that much contact. There are three areas where I think millennials are different from the X generation before them. They perceive the notions of freedom differently, the notions of power differently, and the notion of community differently. I've seen it. You take freedom. I grew up with a very clear understanding of freedom, which you can see at that Republican convention. You know, freedom is to be an autonomous agent, to be independent, to be self-sufficient, to not be beholden to others, and to have freedom as exclusivity. I'm an island to myself. I know how to, I'm in charge of my destiny. I'm a sovereign. Okay? That's how we grew up in many generations since the Enlightenment. For the kids, the millennial generation, for them, the idea that freedom is autonomy, an island to oneself, is death. Take away the smartphone, death. They believe that freedom is the ability to flourish, I mean, to the full extent of their opportunities. For them, freedom to flourish means being in network after network, being continually engaged in communities with each other, continually sharing their talents to the network so it comes back to help them with their social capital. That doesn't mean these kids are angels. They have self-interest, but they also are very socialized on Facebook, on Skyping in global classrooms. So for them, freedom is inclusivity, not exclusivity. For them, freedom is not the ability to be autonomous, but to have access. I see it with the kids. Only the ones, the millennials are really the ones that I see it with. If you look one generation older, not yet, they're not there. This is partially there. Then you see a different idea about power, which is really amazing to me. We always believe, and you said this earlier, power is a pyramid. You mentioned this an hour and a half ago.
Yeah.
But for young millennials who grow up in the internet, power is not a pyramid. The power they have is by being in more and more networks, by having more and more friends, to be in more and more connections. So for them, freedom is lateral. It's not vertical. And freedom is directly proportional to the networks you engage in. It's really kind of a game changer. Then finally, I think the big change, and again, I don't want to stretch this last one, but what we're noticing in the middle class, and in the middle class around the world at least, is they have a completely different idea of community, of how they locate community. And that is, I grew up in a post-Westphalian world, every individual is a sovereign. We compete with other individuals who are citizens and they're sovereigns, and we compete with each other for scarce resources in the marketplace, zero-sum game. Everybody, is an agent competing with each other for scarce resources in the market. And we're all sovereign, okay? And our nation states represent all the individual citizens, they're sovereign. And they compete with other nation states in the marketplace or the battlefield for those same scarce resources, zero-sum game. Which raises the question, how the hell are you going to deal with climate change and bringing the whole human family together and saving this planet if that's the worldview? It just won't work. That's the geopolitical worldview. Take the young millennials. An increasing number of middle-class young people are coming home from school and they're saying, why is Dad using so much water while he's shaving, wasting the water? We're in drought here. Or why is the TV on? We haven't been in the room in 3 weeks. Why two cars? Why not car sharing? I'll tell you the one I really love, we have young people coming home saying, where'd the hamburger come from on the plate? They're learning that everything they do is intimately connected and affects some other human, some other species, the ecosystems in which we live. It's not academic. They're beginning to extend their empathic regard, as they've done in the past. I mean, we went from empathy on blood ties and then empathy on religious ties and ideological ties, psychological ties. The kids are starting to just begin to see themselves as part of an indivisible community of other humans and other creatures and stuff. I don't think it's a big movement yet, but I certainly see it when I talk to young people from the ages of 14 or 15 to around 28 or 30. I do not see that in the older generations at all. What do you think about that? I just don't see it.
I think it's unevenly distributed. It's very hard for me to have a very generalized view of millennials. I know there've been all kinds of studies, millennials are this or that, but there's nothing sadder on this planet than a bunch of middle-aged people sitting in a conference room trying to figure out what millennials are about.
I agree. They're just the early adopters are what I'm talking about.
Here's my concern. I don't want to frame it this way, but I'm going to do it anyway. I've always said, well-intentioned idiot can do just as much damage as an evil mastermind. I think there are a lot of really well-intentioned people who are as likely to destroy things as if they were evil masterminds. So what's missing in all of this is intellectual rigor. I see a lot of really good kids who want to do the right things. They want to carry the signs. But I don't think they want to dig under the hood to really understand, is the methodology of the study they're looking at logical? Who sponsored that study? Is GMO good or is it bad? Is a binary thought. You need to get one level deeper and try to understand, can I separate the actions of Monsanto from the science of GMO? They have every intention of wanting to do the right things, but they don't have the force of intellect to actually drill down into the underlying mechanics of it to make really smart analytical decisions.
I would say that's a huge concern. You'll see I talk about that quite a bit in the Empathic Civilization, which is unfortunately it's 660 pages, but I spent 7-8 years on that book, I guess just so I could read it. Even my family hasn't read it. But in any event, I spent a lot of time dealing with that, and I think my big concern is that we now live in a world where we have to think systemically, and we have to think many levels of complexity. We have to be able to deal with all sorts of contradictions. We have to be able to live in a world that is unpredictable, that requires choices where there are no easy mandates. And thinking systemically is the biggest difficulty we face. When we do these regional breakouts, and, you know, I've worked with a lot of government leaders and over the years, and I have to say that there is almost an amnesia in terms of thinking systemically and critically. Can't add anything to what you said. I agree with that.
There's such a strong reactionary strain in this culture because people are wired into modalities as if they are religions. They will hashtag something. They will automatically gang up on somebody, try to get them fired without really understanding nuance, without really analyzing why someone did this. So they will focus on a latter stage problem without ever addressing a root cause and not even having the desire to seek it because they have been programmed somehow to make up their mind about an issue by someone influential or by some article or some site that has an agenda. 90% of what I see people fighting for, they don't have a mastery of the root cause. And that scares the crap out of me.
This is one of those concerns that I think is so paramount. It's made so easy now with the internet and the internet things that it's easy not to dig deep. So that goes back to the question to why are we being connected? What is the purpose? You mentioned the word analytical. I think that systemic thinking requires something deeper in the human circuitry, which is the ability to evolve our empathic sensibilities, which are built into our neural circuitries. Empathy, the ability to wonder, the ability to imagine, all depends on that quality of empathy, the ability to actually transcend oneself and experience the other, their pleasure, their pain, their maybe experience, whatever it is, as if for our own.
I'd like to connect this to a point you made earlier, which is how the language is suffering because people aren't communicating with as many words. You know, a lot of it has to do with people just aren't reading. Only 33% of people after graduating college actually read another book.
They're not exposed to the words anymore on the page.
That's
exactly right.
So then the question becomes, instead of forcing them to engage in a medium that you and I agree is very effective and very necessary so you can be equipped to think systemically and empathically and analytically, all three, or do we try to find a way that we can use these new tools because people are streaming video, people are using podcasts, they are engaging through this? Is there a way to approximate the depth that you would achieve through the written word in a book?
When we went to the novel was an incredible instrument. People were able to experience characters that were not, they were totally fictional. They could feel the emotions of those characters. They became part of it. They could experience their joy, their fear, their concern, the dangers they were in. And this allowed people in a private setting, they could begin to experience these other fictional characters and then go inside of themselves and be introspective about their own experiences. It was an amazing thing, the novel. To some extent, film does that too. You know Eddie Moretti? He's one of the three guys that runs Vice. He's the creative VP. We've been looking at augmented reality and virtual reality. What happens when you can be placed in the actual environment in real time, not edited? In other words, for example, they now have taken something like, I think it was the U.S. Open, and they could put you there in real time right there. What happens when one can be almost in a quantum way in another place at the same time as something's unfolding now, and then not just watching it, but participating in it? It could also become just a mechanism for voyeurism and entertainment. A lot of it depends on the learning experience and the context and how we come to it. I'm always concerned when I see kids on a street corner and there's eight of them there, none of them talking to each other when they're waiting for the bus, all looking at their cell phones. Then it even gets more alarming when you see them with their parents out at dinner somewhere and no one's talking. No one's socializing. Or every time the kids open their mouth, you hear them say like this, like that. That means they don't know the word. The kids are also becoming pretty global. They're less prejudiced. They're more open. There's a lot of things going both ways. So I'm kind of with you on this. The script has not been written, and it's going to be written by these young people. Americans can move quickly if we get the story right. You know, we're future-oriented. But I'm very alarmed at the dumbing down here that's going on. And I smell when I come back a country that, with all the technology, is starting to feel like a second-tier place. And it doesn't need to be that way. The young people here are no different than young people anywhere else. And I think we have to move from maybe from a Silicon Valley to Biosphere Valleys and get people thinking in terms of how we steward the entire regions we live in and use the Internet of Things and use all this digital technology to connect the human race. Otherwise, why the hell are we connecting ourselves? Well, voyeurism and a few games? I don't think that is the purpose. I think young people are searching for that transcendence, but there's no narrative to accompany it, so they're blindly searching.
That is the great paradox of this communication platform that you described earlier. The thing that's bringing us closer together with almost anyone on Earth is also separating us from the very people we're sitting next to on the train or in the or in our own family or at the dinner table. One of the conclusions in my forthcoming book is going to center around community. The commons is really your framing of basically that logic where we have to find a way to work together using these tools. I think one of the problems is we've gerrymandered our lives. You look at the economic separation. The people who are wealthy and affluent have a life that does not include any of the people that are struggling or that are lashing out in terms of Trump or in terms of Black Lives Matter or in terms of any of these other groups that they really have no exposure to on a day-to-day basis, not in any meaningful way. And similarly, when they go online, Facebook only shows them the posts they want to see. It only shows them the news sources they want to see. We've bubbled ourselves off. And so the only community we're capable of creating is either one of exactly like-minded individuals or one that is almost academic and alien to us where we feel empathically, yeah, that's kind of the right thing, but it's still this alien experience because you've never lived with people of mixed race or you've never lived people with mixed economic backgrounds or from other cultures or from other religions. And all of a sudden, even if you have that desire for empathy, you can't form community with those people and you can't even engage with their issues, not in any meaningful way, certainly not to the point where you would use your tax dollars or advocate for, let's say, incremental tax dollars to help them catch up in terms of education. You just won't do that.
Yeah, you don't see it. That empathy isn't there, and therefore you become more constricted. I think that's why this emerging biosphere consciousness is really important. Once kids see that the story that we've created, which is that climate change is now changing the planet we live in, and look at how many movies are now being done on this, you know? Or we have to go to another planet if we destroy this planet. Once the kids see that, they can go two ways. They can either say, we have a responsibility for each other and our fellow creatures in the earth, or they can say, oh my God, it's all over, and become cynical. But I think the millennials generation, as ill-informed as they may be, they're getting this new story. It's not being taught formally in the schools, I'm sure, and that would never happen, but they're beginning to see this.
Hope you enjoyed that. There's lots more where that came from. I'll have all the links in the show notes. Jeremy's a really interesting guy, very deep thinker. Hopefully you got as much out of it as I did talking to him. And if you enjoy this, tell a friend. Tell lots of friends. And don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next week on The McFuture. I'm Steve Factor.